just say doing this.
But you're right.
Doing this delay is the witness list start to shrink immensely. We're going to start scheduling hearings for 11:30 at night.
Jeff fought you for doing that. Did you hear about those meetings?
Yeah.
No one there. But
oh, we're on. Good afternoon, everyone. Continuation of the Criminal Judiciary Committee. Glad to have you all back here this afternoon. I had agreed that we would return to the hearing on House Bill 2664. I believe we finished 2663, and we are on 2664, although I don't recall. Okay, no, I think we did, 2664. So the last panel then would be that trio known so well here in the Civil or in the Criminal Judiciary Committee of Bill Hauser, Kathy Osborne, and Andrea Meyer.
I was trying to do a radio intro, Carl, but I knew I'm
not quite up to speed.
Max, give yourself about a year of that. You'll be there.
Singing that old favorite, "We Hate This Bill."
Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Andrea Meyer. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, and we do oppose House Bill 2664. DNA collected from one person not only reveals personal information about the person, but also reveals very personal information about that person's blood relatives. Unlike fingerprinting, which only reveals information that can be used for identification purposes, DNA gives the government control over a great deal of personal, private information that anyone related to the sample source, about anyone related to the sample source. We believe any expansion of the government's power to collect DNA from its citizens, even people convicted of crime, should not be taken lightly. DNA testing and profiles are becoming increasingly common. In 1998, the FBI opened a national database that brings together the DNA records from all 50 states and the federal government into one centralized system known as CODIS, or CODIS, Combined DNA Index System, excuse my pronunciation. If this trend is continued, the most intimate and personal information about each individual could routinely become part of a national database to be used and potentially abused at the government's discretion. Initially, these DNA storehouses were created to house information about convicted sex offenders exclusively, and you heard testimony this morning about that. The argument was that sex offenders were especially prone to recidivism, typically left DNA evidence of the crime, and hence were important to identify. Whether or not that argument was sufficient, we have already expanded this into other crimes and now here attempt to expand it even further. And as I mentioned earlier this morning, there is also a bill before the Senate Judiciary that would expand DNA testing to all felony crimes. Slowly, the pool of people being tested and the ranges of potential uses for the data is expanding, raising grave concerns for personal privacy. In the last decade, law enforcement officials across the country have gone from advocating collection of DNA from only convicted sex offenders to all offenders, to all violent offenders, to all burglars, to all persons convicted of any crime, to all juvenile offenders. In many states, the DNA record is maintained even if the conviction is overturned. Louisiana has gone one step further. A new state law will collect DNA data from everyone arrested for a felony crime before they have been convicted. In Louisiana, the record can be kept if the person is found innocent. Former U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno asked the National Commission on the Future of DNA Evidence to look into the possibility of applying this concept across the country. In December 1998, New York City Police Commissioner Howard Safer jumped on the bandwagon proposing the same idea, and New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani not only voiced his support for the proposal, but also went so far as to say that he would support the collection of DNA samples from all babies at birth, giving the city a genetic database for all its citizens. The use
playing right into Representative Wilson's concerns on this week.
And let
you're
me
doing a great doing a great job, Andrea.
Thank you, Chair. And let me continue. The use of DNA is even expanding more. In Costa Mesa, California, detectives have collected DNA samples from over 188 innocent people in an unsuccessful attempt to find a man who raped and murdered a woman. The police surmised that the killer knew his victim and asked any man who knew the victim for a mouth swab. Although the tests were, quote, voluntary, if any individual refused, it raised a red flag to the police. In Los Angeles, 200 persons were tested. In Miami, police tested more than 2,300 men. Neither of these cases resulted in identifying a suspect. And what happens to all the collected DNA? In Ann Arbor, Michigan, the police had a vague description of a serial rapist identifying him as black. The police obtained DNA data from 160 African-American men. Although this DNA collection was not successful in identifying a suspect, and the rapist was subsequently caught when he attacked again, when the news broke of the arrest, one of the men who had been tested sought to have his sample returned. However, the police refused. It took a 2-year legal battle against the state before the judge ordered authorities to return his DNA sample. The collection of DNA samples has legitimate and vital medical, scientific, and forensic purposes. Research can lead to treatments and even cures for many genetic diseases. DNA can prove that an individual was at the scene of a crime or a suspect is innocent, preventing terrible miscarriage of justice. And DNA can even be used to correct wrongful convictions based upon erroneous identification. And as discussed earlier, and we've been participating in the bill that Representative Shetterly is working on DNA testing for post-conviction innocence project-related issues. But it is equally clear that there is a tremendous potential for abuse. The vast amount of information to be gleaned, the incredible longevity of DNA samples, and the ease with which DNA databases can be shared across the country and accessed raise grave privacy, equality, and due process concerns. Though DNA has been touted as high-tech equivalent to fingerprints, and we heard that testimony this morning, this comparison is dangerously misleading. Where fingerprints can be used for identification purposes only, DNA can provide insight into the breathtaking wealth of singularly private information, information regarding a person's family, ethnicity, family history, and the likelihood of getting some 4,000 genetic conditions and diseases. This information belongs to each individual, not the government. Further, geneticists are constantly increasing the database information that can be gleaned from DNA. Some even claim that there are genetic markers for criminal tendencies, substance abuse, and so on. The possibilities, and thus the dangers, are truly endless. Today, the growing law enforcement databases raise the immediate specter of widespread discrimination. Given the over-targeting of African-American, Latinos, and other minorities within the criminal justice system nationwide, the government will have a disproportionate power to track millions of people of color. We receive a number of telephone calls, and we assume that your offices do as well, from constituents who are concerned about government's ever-increasing control over their personal information, social security numbers, census information, background checks, computer privacy, DNA, and genetic information. Because DNA gives personal and private information not only about the individual sample, but also to everyone who shares with that person's bloodline, for people who have never been convicted of any crime, we respectfully urge this committee to not pass House Bill 2664. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Kathy, you'll have to speak a little louder. I'm having trouble hearing over Andrea's black helicopters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Chair, that's just the government.
For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne, senior attorney from Juvenile Rights Project, and in a surprise move, Juvenile Rights Project is opposing House Bill 2664. Let me tell you that although it appears on its face that 2664 would not apply to juveniles, it does, because 419C 473 says that whenever a juvenile is found within the jurisdiction of the court for having committed an act which, if done by an adult, would constitute a felony listed in 137076 subsection 1, that they are also required to give a blood or buccal sample. So not only have we now expanded this group from the adults who are convicted of these, it also includes juveniles who are adjudicated in a juvenile court proceeding, also have to give blood and buccal samples for these crimes. Last session, when the legislature expanded the crimes for which blood and buccal samples, actually they added buccal samples last session, and for which DNA samples are required, They added the burglary in the second degree when the intent is to commit one of the sex crimes listed in sub A and assault in the first degree and burglary in the first degree. When that request was made, the proponents came in with charts and graphs that showed the correlation between convictions of those crimes and later convictions on sex crimes, where DNA samples are readily used. They have not given us that information this time. They haven't shown that high correlation between these crimes or, on the Senate side, any felonies, and shown us a reason why why we believe that people who are convicted or adjudicated on the crimes they want to add would later go and commit crimes where DNA samples are usual evidence in the case, such as the sex crimes. And I would submit that without that evidence, it's just mere speculation that these crimes are crimes that people would, that DNA samples would be certainly helpful for. We also heard testimony this morning that if somebody's conviction was overturned, that the blood and buccal sample is then removed from the DNA database. For juveniles, that's not necessarily true. While fingerprints and photograph files need to be expunged if a juvenile's record is expunged or the conviction is set aside or overturned, ORS 419A260, this is quite a statute. Sub 1, capital K, provides that blood samples, buccal samples, and other physical evidence and identification obtained are not records which are expunged if the juvenile then goes and gets an expungement record. So while we take the fingerprints out of the file if the juvenile gets his or her record expunged, we do not take the blood sample or the buccal sample out of the DNA list. Also last session in Senate Bill 740, there was an expansion of what crimes constitute a sex crime for the purposes of registration. Because kidnapping in the second degree is actually a crime that's extremely easy to commit, and is not your usual kidnapping type scenario that you think of somebody taking somebody and holding them for ransom, but rather kidnapping in the second degree can be somebody going over to somebody's house, saying, I want to talk to you, grabbing them, pulling them outside the door for the purpose of perhaps against their will, moving them for some short distance against their will is kidnapping. It can be kidnapping in the second degree. And from that I get that example from a folder that the Multnomah County DA's office has put together for juveniles regarding what is a Measure 11 crime. And I can certainly bring that folder in and show you the example that was given by the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. But because that is such an easy crime to commit, last session's legislature decided not to make kidnapping in the second degree a registrable crime for juveniles. However, these juveniles under this bill would be required to give blood and buccal samples. So we don't think that we need to know where they are in terms of registration, but we do think we need to have their DNA samples. While we are waiting for the committee, I was checking my phone messages, and I got a phone message about an 11-year-old who was just adjudicated out in Deschutes County on sex abuse. That means this 11-year-old will have to give a blood and buccal sample, probably, since they don't usually take blood samples anymore. And his buccal sample, his DNA, will remain in the DNA sample base for the rest of his life, and probably even on beyond that, unless they take them out prior to his death. We did hear that they remove records in some cases when the person turns 80 years old. But that 11-year-old, for whatever reason, I mean, even if his conviction is later overturned, or his adjudication is later overturned, his DNA sample will remain with the state. I don't think that's the policy that we want to go in with the state of Oregon, and we urge you not to pass House Bill 2664 to the full committee.
before I go on to you, Bill, while it's fresh, I want to ask Kathy a question. The last example you gave, though, that's current law, am I right? I mean, so this bill wouldn't affect the current taking of that 11-year-old's buccal sample or their maintaining that. That is the current law as it exists.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That is correct. That is the current law. I can certainly get the kidnapping in the second degree cases that I have had, and I did a list of them last session for the Senate Judiciary Committee. Most of them have been teenage boys, teenage fathers who have gone over to see their child, who's in the care of the teenage mother. The teenage mother is in a condition to not care for the child. The teenage father, who is not on the birth certificate, who is not a legal father, takes the child because he feels that the child is in danger, and is later charged with kidnapping in the second degree. In those cases, in the cases that I can remember, one of them I got the district attorney to dismiss after the blood sample came back to show that the person who took the child actually was the legal father, because there is a defense for that. In another case where the blood test came back that the person who took the child was the legal father, the district attorney did not dismiss the case, and we actually had to go to trial on that, because the argument that the state had was that he didn't know he was the case. I don't that he was the father at the time that he took the child. I don't know that those kidnapping in the second degree cases are pretty easy. That's an easy charge to get, and I don't think that if we have an 11-year-old getting that charge, we really want to keep their DNA samples.
Kathy, do you believe that 419C 473 and that link to the maintaining the juvenile DNA sample, do you think that was an intentional connection in this bill, or do you think it was an oversight?
Mr. Chair, in this bill, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure about whether it was an oversight. I know that when the blood samples were added to be required for juveniles, that obviously was intentional. I think most people don't realize that the way it's structured is that the juvenile code refers back to the criminal code. In the Oregon Law Commission, one of the problems that we've had in the rewrite of the juvenile code is to try to reduce the number of times that the juvenile code relates back to the adult criminal code or to the domestic relations law or to any other statute, so that these, if it is inadvertent, that those don't continue to happen. But right now, the way this is written, it would include the juveniles. The way you could probably, if you wanted to expand the crimes but did not want to include juveniles in the list of expanded crimes, there's probably a way you could structure the statute to take the juveniles out by just using the term convicted, or to put into 419C that the juveniles who are adjudicated of these subsections do not have to give a buccal sample.
Okay. Bill?
Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I don't have a whole lot to add, as you might have imagined, because the prior witnesses have covered just about everything that I could possibly think of to add to the discussion here today. However, I did want to talk a little bit about the legal standard for the search in order to obtain the samples that are envisioned under this bill. Earlier today, there was some discussion of a case that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has decided. It's State versus, or excuse me, that's not the name of it, Rise versus State of Oregon. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit discusses the rational relationship between the listed crime, or the crimes listed in the Act, that would now include kidnapping in the first degree or second degree, as well as the stalking and robbery in the first degree, and the government interest. The government interest is listed in that case, and I believe the government interest that we've heard discussed during the course of the testimony is the identification and prosecution of sex offenders and murderers. And so when we take a look at the listed the new crimes that are suggested, the kidnapping one and two, the stalking and the robbery in the first degree, I think that it behooves the committee to take a look at that, as well as the attempt to commit murder or aggravated murder. Take a look at those crimes to see whether there's any kind of rational relationship between those crimes and sex offense and murder. Certainly robbery is a crime in which people are put at risk. It is the theft, basically, under being armed. And District Attorney Penn this morning, I think, pretty much in a nutshell defined that. However, there doesn't seem to be a rational link between robbery and necessarily murder that could be linked by DNA. If someone kills during the course of robbery, it's very unlikely, in fact, that DNA might be left at either scene. The same with kidnapping one or two is not necessarily DNA that links. So that there needs to be that rational relationship between the listed crime and the government interest. Stalking, I suppose there could be an argument that the stalking statutes, the Class C felony of stalking, would have with it enough of the component of control in a situation which could be similar enough to something like rape that there at least be the rational relationship. But still, the issue of stalking does not get the... we do not have the situation where in stalking you have the likelihood of DNA being transferred. So that's basically the only thing that I really wanted to add at this point on this particular bill is that rational relationship test that the committee should take a look at before amending the statutes in this way.
Great. Thank you. Are there questions for the panel? I think we understand where your objections to the current version of the bill are. I won't use the time now because the sponsor's not really here and there's not enough of the committee to engage in a discussion. I know there has been some conversation about amendments to this bill. I suspect that any amendments wouldn't probably be sufficient to obtain Ms. Meyer's support for the bill, or likely Mr. Hauser's, as I would anticipate. I do think that there's possibly some amendments that might satisfy Ms. Osborne, and I've asked the sponsors of the bill to investigate that, and we'll see where it goes. So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2664. Thank you very much for being patient with us this morning. I guess I'll open the hearing on House Bill 2378. I'll ask Mr. Hauser to come forward. And Anne Christian, you're listed on here as well with respect to an amendment. Is that right? Do you want to come forward as well? Counsel, do you want to give us a little intro?
Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It limits what can be deducted from the refund of money deposited as part of a security release agreement, a bail agreement, and it's a... not similar, but it's on the same topic as House Bill 3357 from Representative Patridge. The main differences between the two bills is that Representative Patridge's bill pertains to forfeited security bail. In the criminal defense bar, it relates to bail that's not forfeited. And I believe the main issue is should this money be returned to the person who put it up if it's not the defendant, or should it be used for other purposes?
Okay, good. Mr. Hauser.
Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I have submitted to you some written testimony, which is about three-quarters of a page. I'll try not to read it for you. And I've also submitted on the second page of my testimony some potential amendments that, after some discussions with Ms. Christian, other people might work, and frankly, we think are a good idea. So I submit those to you for your consideration as well. The bill that comes before you is at a request of one of the members of our organization. That person had some concerns about money posted for a security deposit for releasing a defendant from jail by third parties. This particular bill will not change the way things happen if, for example, the defendant posts his own security. That money can be used not only for financial obligations arising for the offense for which he is in custody, but also any other debt he might owe the court. That, frankly, in my opinion, does not happen very much. Once a person goes in the bucket, they don't really have enough wherewithal to reach into their pocket and come up with security deposit. Usually someone else posts their security, and that's really the crux of this bill. When a third party posts that security, what happens to that money after the court is done with it? If they post, this bill would allow for third-party money only to be used for the financial obligations for the offense for which the person is being charged and then released from jail. It does not cover those things that are not a part of that financial obligation, other debts, for example, traffic offense violations or things of that type. There's also been some concern about fact that if a third party posts security, that money could not be used for back child support, and that I'm sure you'll be hearing about, and in fact this bill would not allow for that to be used. Our concern is this, that when a third party posts security, they do it for a number of reasons. Some of it because the defendant might give them the money, I'll grant you that. Some of them for other reasons. For an example, an employer may choose to bail out an employee who is necessary to complete a job that is being done right there. That third party does not necessarily know of all the debts of the defendant and does not know that their money could be used for something other than what is obviously at risk, either it being forfeited if the defendant does not show up for court or being used for the financial obligations from that charge. And we believe that that is wrong. We believe that a person who posts security should know of the risks and be informed of those risks, and that the risk should be limited to only those things in which the defendant is being arrested and released at that time. That is the basic position of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Ann, do you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office, specifically the Indigent Defense Services Division, and I need to make clear from the outset that I have come before you to testify only in support of the amendment that OCDLA has submitted, which is page 2 of Mr. Hauser's prepared testimony. And I would join in the request for this amendment for the following purpose. Current law provides that regardless of who has posted security, whether it's the defendant, him or herself, or a third party, that the district attorney's office may move the court for an order to take child support that is in arrears from that security that has been posted. And the Judicial Department is not taking a position other than our fiscal impact statement, which Mr. Swank will address. But we are not taking a policy position as far as the OCDLA bill. But the proposed amendment addresses an issue, Mr. Chair, that just recently came to my attention, is when the district attorney files a motion with the court to have the court order that posted security shall be taken for child support, the law currently provides that the defendant who is the subject of the motion must be served with a copy of the motion. I received a phone call from one of our larger indigent defense contractors in Portland and was informed that law firm was receiving service of these motions on behalf of their criminal defense, indigent defense clients. Mr. Chair, I make a rather concerted effort, and I guess some would say I'm notorious for the fact that indigent defense attorneys are appointed for limited purposes. They are only appointed whenever there is a statutory or constitutional mandate that they be appointed. So when it comes to collateral matters, and I'll give you two examples in addition to this motion that the DA files to take security for child support, as examples of collateral matters to criminal cases that specifically by contract and otherwise, I've taken the position at least that indigent defense attorneys will not be compensated for. And also there's an issue as far as their liability. Our public defender, our not-for-profit contractors, are exempt from PLF provided they have other coverage through some of the national organizations, and that malpractice insurance, at least when I've read the policies, is very much limited to representation in criminal cases and some juvenile cases. And part of my concern about indigent defense attorneys handling matters that clearly are collateral to their criminal representation is twofold. It's state money that's paying for them, and second is the potential for liability. And in this context, it's similar to a situation where on a domestic relations case, if there's indigent defense counsel appointed to the same person who's the subject of a domestic relations matter, and on the criminal matter that person happens to have court-appointed counsel, I don't think many people would argue the fact that appointed counsel is not in a position to be accepting service on behalf of that criminal defendant in a domestic relations case. The two quickly collateral matters that we, for at least as long as I've been with the Office of the State Court Administrator, indicated that we will not allow attorneys to provide collateral representation or DMV hearings. For example, a person charged with driving under the influence has a right to request a civil hearing concerning the license suspension that is attendant to a DUII, and we have specifically exempted representation in DMV hearings from indigent defense representation. The other example is civil forfeiture. Oftentimes it seems natural to defense attorneys that when they're appointed to represent an individual on a criminal matter where assets have been seized and are subject to forfeiture, that criminal defense attorney feels they should assist in the civil forfeiture, and we've taken the clear position that that is not part of their representation. So, Mr. Chair, what I would request is, number one, that it be noted that I'm only in support of the amendments that have been suggested to you by OCDLA, and to also note that if it appears, and I don't know if this is proper, but if it appears, and I have talked with Mr. Hauser about this, if it appears that this bill effectively will be sent to Ways and Means to die, I understand that OCDLA will agree that the bill should be amended simply to make the corrective, as I see it, amendment to existing law. So it's clear that when indigent defense attorneys receive these motions, my advice currently has been send the service back to the district attorney's office, but I would appreciate it having it clear in current law. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Bill, I just have a question for you. In your written testimony, as I read this, essentially it limits what you could, and I'll just try to give the shorthand understanding because it's late in the afternoon, mm-hmm. but it tries to limit what you can currently do with bail that's been essentially put in by a family member or somebody else. But in your testimony, you say fundamental fairness requires at a minimum adequate notice be given before the money, security deposit money, is forfeited to the state.
Mm-hmm.
So you raise sort of an interesting question, because I can understand a parent coming forward, you know, writes the check for getting Johnny out of jail, and then loses the money because he didn't know about Johnny's child support obligation or that Johnny was behind. But to the extent that beforehand there was some sort of a big, bold message that said, FYI, if you're bailing Johnny out and Johnny's got obligations, known or unknown to you, mm-hmm. there is a chance that you will not get your bail back. But forge ahead, you know, ask Johnny, and if Johnny lies to you, that's between you and Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if there was that kind of notice, would that satisfy the OCDLA?
Mr. Chair, no. We believe that the notice that should be given at a minimum should be more specific than that. And we took a look at ways that could happen, for example, that there could be some kind of search instrument or search engine to allow for that at a sheriff's office or a state or a court office, and it really doesn't seem to be practical. And so, no, we don't believe that kind of general knowledge notice would be adequate. We would want more specific.
And I understand the practical problem. It might be practically a little bit of a challenge for some receiving clerk at the county jail to potentially run that. I mean, it might not either. I mean, it's not very hard to come up with a list of people who have judgments against them or something like that. But at the same time, you know, that's one more thing you're going to be asking somebody behind a counter to do that they're not currently doing, and I can understand that. But you don't think that a substantial notice, sort of just forewarning to the possibility without specifics, is sufficient?
We do not believe so. No.
Okay. Questions for either of these people before I release them, and we'll bring up the other witnesses. Ann?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding, I certainly have not surveyed every 36 county circuit court, but it's my understanding that, in fact, the courts do provide a notice on the release agreement that a third party signs and does provide a notice stating the fact that any money posted could be taken and applied to other obligations.
Be interesting to get a copy. Is there a standard form release agreement that every county uses?
It goes from county to county.
It varies from county to county?
I believe so.
Be interesting maybe at some point if somebody could collect two or three examples of that and share them with the committee. I think the committee would be interested in looking at that. Okay, good. Thank you both. Now I'd like Carl Stecker, Rennell Schenkel, and Brad Swank. Carl, why don't you kick off?
Members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County, and here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association with respect to opposition to House Bill 2378. I've handed you today copies of written testimony, which includes an amendment of a case that's actually proceeding currently in Marion County with respect to this issue, and coupled at the very back of that is in fact the form of a notice that's used in Marion County, which specifically in bold print admonishes the person who posts the bail to clearly indicate that the funds can be used for any purposes, and ask them to read this carefully before you pay any money to obtain the release of a defendant from custody. You should understand that the law provides that, and under subparagraph 4, the money posted will be applied against the obligations of the defendant in this case or any other case of the same defendant unless the court expressly directs otherwise on its own or at your request. Furthermore, a most recent case on this subject with respect to the child support issue is the matter of Baker versus the State of Oregon at 165 or at 565. I have a copy of that decision which I'll furnish to counsel for the committee. But in that case involving a Multnomah case, clearly the person who posted the party was signed an agreement that had similar language that warned them that the funds could be utilized for purposes or obligations other than in the instant case in which the funds were posted. Our essential objection to this is that it facilitates a straw person transaction. The criminal defendant can post the funds of his own through a third party and thereby wash the money from the potential uses, which can include not only certainly child support, but also fines, fees, restitution, and other matters. If you look at ORS 135-265, you'll see that the funds aren't just limited to purposes for collection of child support, but might be applied to other obligations of the defendant. And so you have an instance where there may be serial charges, serial matters that have been on which the defendant has been convicted and judgment's been imposed. These funds can then be applied into those former obligations that were already adjudicated. The concept that security deposits are the property of the defendant, no matter by whom posted, has been the law of Oregon for over 70 years. It was earliest, there was some case law cited in my testimony that interpreted an earlier statute that's been on the books at least since 1917 with respect to this ability of the courts to use the funds for these purposes. Frankly, there's also a very specific section now that was enacted since the Baker decision that deals with child support, and that's found in ORS 25715, and I believe it's subsection 3 of the bill. And Clearly, that process is working very well. It's assisting DAs throughout the state in the collection of support. Our most recent statistics are that very close to 200,000 has now been collected in at least 8 different counties that have reported back to an inquiry that we sent. The chief among them, Multnomah, Marion, Jackson, Douglas, and I believe Deschutes. And even Coos County came in with $26,000. So it's a very useful tool and certainly provides resources or is an ability to attach resources that otherwise may be unutilized and might go back for other purposes than the child support. We're not insensitive to the issue that certainly some of the folks who post the money may not be the persons, in fact, who are the child support judgment creditor. But nonetheless, we have to face the fact that they are warned up front. They're given an actual situation. They're given notice of the potential. And as shown in the appendment to my testimony, the judge can certainly inquire. He's got the discretion, or she the discretion, to, in fact, determine whether it's an appropriate use of the funds in a particular case. In the case that I've attached, the facts are such that the criminal defendant was convicted of sex abuse of his minor daughter, and it was the same minor daughter who was the beneficiary of the child support award. So clearly it's the kind of situation where there's a compelling argument that the funds be properly be used. If we have an instance where an elderly grandmother, you know, who mortgages her entire her home to the max to bail out her son, perhaps, and the facts are such, the judge can offer some relief in that and decline to grant it. So, you know, the facts of each case would dictate a judicial determination appropriate to the merits of the case. I'd be glad to answer any further questions, and I will provide a copy of the Baker decision.
Great. Thank you, Carl. Representative Ackerman, we have the other two talk.
Oh, sure.
And then
sure.
Take them all at once. Is that all right?
Yes.
Ronell?
That's fine.
For the record, Ronell Shankel, Department of Justice, Division of Child Support. You have my written testimony before you. Many of the items in my testimony are the same as those already mentioned by Mr. Stecker, so I will not repeat them. We are in opposition to this bill as well. The only things that I would add is that we did have a meeting with Mr. Hauser regarding this bill and shared our concerns. Our conversation was along the same paths that both he mentioned in his testimony and Chair Williams brought forward about making the notice perhaps stronger, if that's the concern, that the third parties aren't truly aware that this money may go to pay a child support debt. The other piece that I would add, in addition to what Carl has said, is that even through our process, there is still a motion to intercept these funds served on the parties. They have an opportunity to object and ask for a hearing. Not only can the court make a determination that, no, we shouldn't be able to intercept the money, but certainly, at least in our division, our assistant attorney generals could make a determination that this is not an appropriate case to go forward. Perhaps we're going to harm other children in the household or something that would not meet our mission. So not only do the courts have discretion, but we certainly have discretion to do the right thing if it is a third party posting these monies and we will be doing some other harm to another family. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ronell. Brad?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. We actually haven't taken a policy position on this bill, but I thought I would come and fill you in on some background as to how this bill works and what it may affect, so you've got more information with which to make your decision. First, I'd like to say that my comments are directed to the bill as originally drafted and printed, and not to Ann Christian's amendments, which she's supporting, which we think are a good idea, because we work in the same office. A number of years ago, in the early 90s, the State Court Administrator's Office worked with the legislature to create a revenue stream that comes out of the courts, and it's a revenue stream that consists of all of the state's portion of monies that come out of criminal cases, and that includes fines, it includes unitary assessment, it includes forfeited bail, it includes all of those sorts of things, and it creates a predictable revenue stream that we can provide to the legislature that the legislature can then spend on appropriate programs, most of which are in the criminal justice area, although you heard one this morning that is a way of preventing a crime by providing services to children. Among the services that are provided through that revenue stream, there are monies that go to victims of crime, to abused children, to victims of domestic abuse, to the state police crime lab and other functions of the state police, money that goes to education. For forfeited bail, there's money that for forfeited security release amount, there's actually money that goes directly to local governments. There's money that goes to sexual assault victims, to wounded police officers and their families, and to rural emergency medical services. And there's money that goes to others that comes out of that revenue stream, including the possibility of programs for kids that you talked about this morning. None of the money sticks in the hands of the courts. Now, as originally drafted, House Bill 2378 takes money out of this revenue stream, and it takes money out that would otherwise be used for that purpose, because it's quite common among courts, and we don't know how many, but we've talked to most of them that we've talked to say that, yes, if they've got somebody who's posted bail and they have outstanding fines that they haven't paid, they take some of that money to pay those fines, that money then goes into that revenue stream. And most courts have told us that they put people on notice and try and make it very clear to them. And the judges I've talked to say that if it's the case of the grandmother losing her house that she's posted for security to release, they try and make the decision not to put them out of their home. So that puts you in a context of what will happen. We assume that, as others do, that if this bill is passed, all of the security release money will be posted by second parties. Because it will become a standard procedure, because people would be stupid not to, because they can limit the use that the money would otherwise be put to, and we assume that defense attorneys will be advising them, you know, even if you've got money, give it to your friend, have your friend post it, because that way a third party will be doing it. It's the straw man that Mr. Stecker spoke about. So we're assuming this will place a limit on these revenues, and of course that's your decision if you wish to make that policy decision about how you limit those revenues. You can do that, but we wanted you to have the context for how we thought that would affect. We don't know how big the revenue impact would be. Anecdotally, we think it will be substantial. At least $100,000 would come out of the revenue stream, maybe many, many times that, because many courts use this process of putting the money into the revenue stream. I'm here to answer any questions about the criminal fines and assessments account and that revenue stream that I can, and I'll also speak on the other bill when that's up.
Great. Thank you, Brad. I know that Representative Ackerman has questions.
And this is directed to all of you because I think you all have specialized interest in this, but the way I read ORS 25.715 and the current law, it is likely that funds deposited by a third party could be seized to satisfy the debt of the defendant. Now, it seems to me if that's what's occurring, and I'm assuming in this hypothetical that the funds are legitimately posted by a third party, but you're applying those funds to the debt of a defendant, how can that be constitutionally done? Aren't you taking money for a third party to pay the defendant's debt? Isn't that a wrongful seizure of those funds? And I ask that because the way ORS 215.715 is set up, there's a series of questions that are asked of the court, and the question is not asked of the court whose money is posted. Now, I see your opposition, and I see the current law as creating liability for you under these circumstances. Am I right?
Do you want to start? Sure. Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, with respect to, I think, the issue of whose money is it to begin with, the dilemma that we're faced, I suppose, is the court's own interpretation for a long time that any money posted on behalf of a criminal defendant is treated as though it's the property of the defendant. And therein probably lies the nut or kernel of the issue you raise. Under a constitutional attack, I suspect that the question of notice and due process would come up, and certainly the question of notice is addressed with the forms that I believe are not universally, but certainly a similar form of notice being utilized in any case where a third party posts would address that issue, because they are being told up front that essentially these funds might stand for some other debt. Maybe you have a duty of inquiry, in effect, before you post this money. However, absent that, I would tend to agree with you that there may be some issue there with respect to certainly that party needing notice in the proceeding. As it turns out, our practice is routinely, and in this instant case that I've attached to my testimony, we have given notice to the third party of that proceeding. We consolidated the civil proceeding in which the child support judgment was entered with the criminal proceeding in which the bail was posted, and gave notice to the third party. So I would agree that that's the best practice, is for all parties to be heard.
Representative Ackerman, it's an interesting question that you raised, but I guess I come down on the due process aspect. The question is the notice sufficient? If the notice is sufficient, then I think you avoid the hang-up. If it's not, and it's deemed not, you've got a problem. And as everyone here has pointed out, the notice language is not uniform. There's nothing that obligates the counties to give a uniform notice. And I've indicated, I think, to Mr. Hauser that while I'm not generally supportive of pulling back the current version of the law in its entirety, I am interested in probably putting something forward that unifies the language of the appropriate notice, maybe even requires that it appear on the form in, you know, I don't know, 20-point type or whatever makes reasonable sense. But to make that notice to the degree that we think it would withstand the kind of challenge that you're suggesting, in that I think we do a couple of things. We provide some protection for the system, which is currently using this. We give the people a better option before they just sign something to know that they really are giving up a potential right. And while it might not directly address the concerns of Mr. Hauser, it at least maybe gets them a little bit further down the road than where they thought they would be, which is having people come back and say, gee, I didn't know I was going to lose my stuff when I posted bail. So that's sort of where I'm headed. I guess I'd be interested in any comments from the committee about that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was sitting here thinking about, 8 or 10 years ago, we posted bail for a friend who called in the middle of the night and been arrested. And had I known that we could have lost our $300 to pay back child support or whatever, I wouldn't have bailed him out of jail. And I frankly, I'm trying to remember back that long whether there was any notice provided to me. And if there was, I sure don't remember it, because I would have thought twice. We were very, very poor at the time and couldn't afford to lose $300. So I'm sort of with you about just making that notice more uniform, more clear. I don't like the idea of getting rid of the notice or giving the money back, because your testimony was very telling about how they'll just have someone else pay the bill and they'll always avoid getting collections applied to past child support and things like that. So I'm sort of leaning your direction.
What I guess what I'd like to do is have perhaps maybe you, Mr. Stecker, since you're representing the district attorneys here, maybe Rennell, talk to Mr. Hauser and see if you guys can work together on coming up with some appropriate notice language that everybody could live with and that was of the appropriate size and scope, and bring the thing back. Okay, with that, we're going to close the hearing then on House Bill 2378. Appreciate everybody's work there. We're now going to open a hearing on House Bill 3489, and I'm going to ask Ms. Botkin, Nick Armenicus, and Jim Reed to all come up.
What's the bill number?
I am punch drunk. I'm so tired, I'm not sure.
I'm so tired from going committee to committee.
And I have one more.
You have another one? Oh, are you going back?
I think that number, because I missed another one. The last one, because another one.
I can't go back.
So we're open. Good afternoon, everyone. Why don't we start with Mr. Armenicus?
Thank you. Chair Williams and member of the committee, I'm Nick Armenicus of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information and support for HB 3489, which was introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections. The department is required to provide state prison inmates with adequate health and treatment. However, the department is unable to provide inmates all the necessary health care services within the confines of its correctional facilities. Consequently, the department must routinely transport inmates into the community to obtain a variety of inpatient, outpatient, and emergency health care services. With the expansion of Snake River Correctional Institution, Ontario, 3,000 inmates, and the opening of 1,632 beds at the Two River Correctional Institution in Umatilla, the department has found it increasingly necessary to transport inmates across the borders into Boise, Idaho, and the Tri-City area in Washington State, and to obtain necessary health care services in those areas. In reviewing the department's out-of-state medical transports with the State Attorney General's office, the department has been advised that it could be subject to civil and or criminal liabilities under the laws of Washington and Idaho for allowing transport officers to carry and use weapons in connection with the Armed Transport Department inmates in those states. HB 3489 seeks to address some of these concerns by permitting the superintendent of the state police to grant peace officer status to certain Department of Corrections officers involved in medical transports by appointing them as special state police officers. With this authority, the department will seek to enter into agreements with the states of Washington and Idaho. These agreements will permit the department's transport officers to exercise the powers, privileges, and authority of peace officers in connection with medical transports of the department inmates in those states. The department anticipates the fiscal impact of HB 3489 to be minimal due to the small number of transport officers who will need peace officer status. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Why don't we have all of you testify, and then we'll do questions. Mayor, I'm going to you check neutral, the other two check four. So I'm going to go with the pros, and then we'll move to you.
That works for me, sir.
Okay. So go ahead, Jim. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, Chair Williams.
Jim and I spent some time together in Boston this summer.
Yeah.
Boston? How do you say that accent?
No, you got to ask Taylor's the Bostonian here. Not me.
Well, Chair Williams and the committee members, I'm Jim Reed. I'm a captain with Oregon State Police, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill today. The Department of Corrections Director and the Superintendent were discussing this issue, and the Department of Corrections was looking for some authority from the Superintendent to help them in the area of medical transport, as Nick Arminicus testified to. The superintendent didn't have that authority under statute after we did some research. His authority is pretty specific in his ability to designate people as special state police officers. This statute was drafted up consistent with some of the other provisions in Chapter 181 that allow the superintendent to make those special appointments. And I'm here to affirm that he wants to assist the Department of Corrections in being able to confer that authority on the people in Corrections Division who need it in order to perform their duties. That's all the testimony I have, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Great. Go ahead, Mary.
I bet you're opposed.
She says she's neutral on her checkoff, but maybe she's...
I'm absolutely neutral on this, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. This bill accomplishes little of what we need to have it accomplish, though, as I have been told many, many times, a half a loaf is better than none, and crumbs are better than no loaf at all. I've worked with the department for many years under many directors and many superintendents of state police in trying to obtain some level of authority for the on behalf of corrections officers who are placed in an untenable situation. And as we build our prisons more and more in rural Oregon, they are placed in more and more risk with little authority to act in a responsible, quick, and manner in order to protect the public and themselves and other folks from inmates. We introduced Senate Bill 779. We thought with the department's support. In fact, we thought we were doing it because the department didn't feel that it could. Senate Bill 779 is before Senate Judiciary, and it would give full police status or peace officer authority
to both transport and fugitive apprehension units of the Department of Corrections. It occurs to me that in the last few weeks, the department has moved away from that position because of budgetary constraints. I just feel like it's imperative that I go on record as saying that we introduced 779 in good faith, that that was indeed what the department needed. House Bill 3489 simply transfers all the authority to the state police, and I guess that's okay. You know, we certainly don't have any problem with the current superintendent of state police, nor did we have any problems with the former superintendent of state police. I'm just not sure they ought to be the ones making those kinds of policy decisions. I thought that's what you all were for. And I still kind of think that the legislature ought to be the one deciding who they want to be police officers and who they don't want to be police officers. And I guess I'm just waiting for the day that we're looking for one of our sworn corrections officers to find out that they're either all out sick or on vacation, and we don't have one. And I don't know how they're going to make this work, but we certainly are willing to work with the department to try and make that work.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Let me ask you gentlemen, are the people who are potentially, I assume that the transport, like a lot of things, although it sounds easy, isn't. I mean, you know, typically, just from my experience of visiting some of your institutions, that, you know, there's a lot of procedure, a lot of training that goes into deciding how you're going to transport people, even for medical purposes. Are the people involved in this, are they going to be required to go through any kind of additional training in order to qualify? And you might have mentioned this, Nick, in your testimony, and I may have missed it. Or are they simply going to be sort of given this one-time waiver to do this for purposes of transport only, or are they going to have some additional training?
Chair Williams and members of the committee, we will be working with BPSST to ensure that we develop a curriculum that will require additional training for those people who have been designated by the superintendent of the state police.
Okay. Okay. Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question in response to that, because I was going to ask that same question. If you're developing a curriculum to train these people, I don't get it. Why don't you just train the real officers to do the job instead of these special appointed officers?
Was that directed to anybody in particular?
Well,
Mr. Armenakis, maybe?
Yeah,
okay.
Sounds good.
Chair Williams, Representative Walker. We have to look at the fiscal impact of how many people we can actually train. And looking at the bill the way it was presented today is the dollars we can absorb within the department.
Follow-up question?
You may.
How many escapes have you had when you transport people on medical trips?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, we have no escapes from transport since its inception in 1991. This is basically dealing with our ability to transport inmates out of the state of Oregon,
right,
into Idaho and Washington.
Right.
I understand that. I know recently there's been an escape over somewhere recently, one of those correctional institutions, and I'm just a little concerned if you're not using real corrections officers or police officers or whoever it is that transports, that we may have a higher risk of escape factor here, because these people aren't exactly trained. But
Representative Walker, I think these people are corrections officers. I mean,
right,
they're people who are currently working in the correction system who are doing transport. They're just not currently authorized as peace officers to take these people across,
right,
state lines, and that's the issue that we're attempting to address.
Right.
And in those areas out in Snake River and other places, you basically got to go to Idaho to get
healthcare
at certain,
mm-hmm,
levels that they can't provide necessarily in the Ontario community, I'm assuming.
Well, I know Representative Jensen takes his dog to Washington State across the border, and he lives in Pendleton.
Mr. Chair, there's more to, if I might respond a little bit,
yeah,
to Representative Walker's questions. There's a little more for the officer involved than just having additional training and kind of strapping a gun on his hip. This also includes a certain degree of liability coverage. It holds them harmless personally, and it gives them the authority, if you will, to subdue, apprehend, whatever, in a situation where that ill inmate might be trying to escape. Though I doubt that the medical transport is really the biggest problem that we have. You know, our experience has been that when you have problems, it's when you're transporting people to court hearings or to other, you know, other things when the inmate's perfectly healthy. I'm not sure how this bill helps us get back up any faster. Understand that our first responders are always either the county sheriff, the city police, or the state police, whoever is closer. And, of course, we call for their assistance. I haven't figured out how we get them any closer in Eastern Oregon with the passage of this bill, but I understand the fiscal constraints, and
Are you still neutral on this bill, Mary?
You know,
I'm just checking.
You know, Mr. Chair, you know, I think this is a bad bill, but, you know, I'm going to support it because, as I said, crumbs are better than nothing, and this is a first step.
Okay.
I think that this is going to give people a level of comfort that they should not have.
Okay, Representative Krieger has a question.
Chair Williams, I read the bill last night, but I wasn't here for some of the testimony. Did the state police testify in favor of the bill?
They sure did.
And is it limited to medical transport functions and duties?
It sure is. Am I right about that?
Yeah, Representative Williams, Representative Krieger, yeah, it's, it was intended to be limited to just those medical transport functions where they're required to have police authority in other states in order to carry firearms.
Okay, that's all I need to know.
Okay.
It's a simple little bill.
We are closing the hearing on House Bill 3489. We're going to open a work session, and we're going to... Representative Ackerman, do you have questions?
I just have a point of inquiry. I just needed to know how long we're going to proceed tonight and whether you intend to take up House Bill 2337.
Yes. Yes, and I'm going to try to do that while I have a quorum.
Okay.
I think. But let me. Can I get this over with and then we can talk about agenda? We're now in a work session on House Bill 3489. Chair would move House Bill 3489 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, I would have to agree with Ms. Bodkin that crumbs are better than nothing. I prefer the real things, but if this is the best we can get, that's what I'll take.
Then crumbs it will be. Any objection? Bill moves to the full committee. Representative Walker, you want to carry it up to the floor?
Take the crumbs.
Sure.
You want to carry this crummy bill?
Take it.
The crumbs bill.
Up to the full committee. Thank you.
All right.
Now we are House Bill
2337.
Before we open the work session, Representative Ackerman, do you have a question or a comment?
Well, I have two commitments at 5, and I've already been committed to another committee since 3:30, but I've been here.
We appreciate
it. And
that.
I do have some substantial comments on 2337, so...
So you would not be prepared to move the bill today?
Not if I have to stay past 5.
We have Jim Nass here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, could I...
Yes, please.
We have the -1 amendments in front of us. And we have Jim Nass here from the Court Administrator's Office, who is the attorney for the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. He's here, I think, to explain any questions on the amendments. He may be able to give us an idea of whether it will take more than 15 minutes.
If we're going to have problems with the bill, I can't move it today even if I wanted to, because...
I have problems with the bill.
Do you?
Yes.
Even with the dash one amendments as they're currently
with
written?
With the dash one amendments, yes.
Okay. Then what I guess I'd like to do is, knowing that, I'd encourage Mr. Nass to talk with Representative Ackerman, and I think my preference would be to not take additional committee time at this moment to work the bill. And we'll wait pending that resolution. So that takes us then to House Bill 2363. And I appreciate your, I recognize these afternoon hearings, you have through some of this, are going to be hectic, and we're going to be in and out as we attend other committee business. And I appreciate members, you making the efforts that you make to try to do this. So with that, we're going to open up a hearing on House Bill 3263. There are two people signed up, Fred Lenzer from Multnomah County. And
he's not here, Mr. Chair. He left us some written material.
Okay.
And I will pass it out.
And Mr. Hauser, you want to come up? This is one of those bills that's coming forward with the support of the Multnomah District Attorneys Association and the OCDLA. Am I right about that?
That is correct,
Chair
Williams.
Wow, we broke bread.
My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We think this is a great idea. That pretty much takes care of my testimony.
I love this time
of
session.
Chair Williams, you should go to afternoon sessions all the time.
speechless.
I can't believe that.
What you have in front of you, colleagues, from Mr. Lenzer, is the this would essentially authorize a diversion program for individuals who were found in violation of ORS 165-065, which is the crime of negotiating a bad check, essentially, and there's specific language using words like drawee and things like that that confuse most of us, but that's essentially what this does. It's a, sort of a novel idea. It addresses, I think, a problem that they're currently feeling like they have with respect to how they treat these issues. And maybe, Mr. Hauser, you can give me some practical information. I'm very sorry we weren't able to accommodate Mr. Lenzer earlier today because I was interested in hearing his testimony. But what are they currently doing? Are they currently just sort of ignoring this for the most part? And so this is sort of a better-than-nothing approach?
Yeah. Chair, I think that in the larger counties particularly, they just simply don't charge negotiating a bad check. And in my county, they happen to under very strict guidelines. But in large counties, they just simply don't have the resources to do that because there are civil actions that are carried with a bad check as well. And this particular program would be pre-charging. So if when the case comes through from the police to the...
Representative Ackerman, I'm sorry. If I wanted to move this bill, would you stick around for this one while we can keep a quorum?
This is pre-charging so that they can basically do the help the commercial establishments collect their checks without having to go through the actual criminal process.
Okay. I think it's a good idea to the extent that in most of the larger counties they're not doing anything. This may be a way to get some of these people, which seem in some cases to be pretty chronic. I mean... So the idea of a diversion program theoretically would address that. Any other? There is no one else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else here who wants to talk about this concept? Thanks, Bill. So we'll close the public hearing, move to work session on House Bill 3263. Discussion committee?
Well, I'm just sitting here, Mr. Chair, thinking about how this would apply to payday lenders and people who default on those checks. Payday lenders right now can sue you for presenting a dishonored check, even though you post-date the darn thing. It's a bad check because they don't have the money when they write it. But I don't know. I'm just going to give it some more thought. I like the bill.
Okay. All right.
But it just would apply maybe to something else I'm working on.
Well, think about that as it's moving towards the full committee. How
yeah.
About? Okay. So with that, the chair would entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to move 3263 to the full committee with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3263 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Bill moves.
Carrier.
Carrier could be Representative Krieger. Okay. House Bill 3357. We will open a hearing on that one. Representative Ackerman, if you need to go, I think that's probably the rest of what we're going to be able to move out today.
I appreciate the accommodation, but...
I appreciate you being here.
I'm scheduled twice this afternoon, and...
Yep, I understand.
Phase two right now.
And I have Ronell and Brad Swank signed up on this one.
Oh, we had this morning.
Right, we weren't able to finish it. I think Representative Packard testified. I'm not sure anyone else did.
That's all I had. I was watching on TV.
We have the dash one amendments in the bill, too.
Did those get adopted?
No.
Okay.
No, one second.
Okay, so there are dash one amendments on the bill. Ms. Schenkel?
For the record, Ron L. Schenkel, Department of Justice. And my apologies, the Deputy Attorney General was not able to join us this afternoon, but I am speaking on behalf of the department at this time. And also I'm handing out from the Child Support Program Director's Office a copy of their written testimony from this morning. They were not able to return either. The Department of Justice is here in opposition to House Bill 3357 due to some concerns that we have. There were two concerns with the original bill as drafted. We talked with Representative Patridge about these concerns. One of them was the repeal of 25715, which is handled by the Dash 1 amendments. So with the passage of those amendments, that concern would be addressed. However, our remaining concern is the issue of the potential impact on other entities that currently receive potential funding from bail forfeitures or security deposit forfeitures, such as the Crime Victims Assistance Program. We have not had time to work with other entities about how this might impact them if child support were added to the mix, and especially if we were given priority, and we would like the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Brad?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with State Court Administrator's Office. Again, we haven't taken a position on this bill, but we wanted to let you know some of the particulars. Ms. Schenkel has raised some of them, and we talked about them, some of them before on the previous bill dealing with unitary assessment, the fact that there are other people in this revenue stream, other entities that the legislature has funded, and this would affect the revenue stream going to them, potentially taking money out of them. But there are also some technical issues I wanted to raise. First of all, when we looked at the bill, we thought that probably page 2, line 42, was a drafting error. We worked very hard with the Support Enforcement Division last session to put that into to work out that particular section of statute, which is ORS 25715. They've used a lot, made a lot of money from it, and I was glad to hear Representative Patrick say this morning that it was a drafted error, because we thought that was. The second issue that comes up with the bill as drafted is an issue about judgments. The way the bill is currently drafted, it raises a concern about judgments that I can best explain by giving you an example. Let's assume, for instance, that Mr. Taylor is something of a deadbeat for purposes of this example, and he owes me $100, and he owes Representative Walker $100. And we both bring an action against him. We each get our own judgments against Mr. Taylor for the $100 that he owes us. Now, I collect $100 from Mr. Taylor because I've got reasonable enforcement mechanisms, and I turn around to Representative Walker and I say, you know, I know what representatives get paid, and you need this money more than I do, so here, I give the money to Representative Walker in payment of part of the debt of Mr. Taylor. Now, the question that arises from that is, has Mr. Taylor, who was a deadbeat, has he suddenly become a sly dog because he's managed with a $100 payment to now pay off $200 worth of debts? The question that arises is the status of the judgments that are created for those original debts when money is transferred from one judgment creditor to another judgment creditor in recognition of that debt. This bill brings that legal issue into conflict because you've got a judgment creditor, the state, for the judgment that's created when the person fails to appear for the bail money and the money that would otherwise go into this revenue stream, and you've got another judgment creditor, and that's the person who's owed the child support.
And when you've got money being transferred, what is the status of that judgment? It has to do with more than the amount that's on deposit, because as you may or may not know, when a security release deposit is made under the Oregon statutes, mostly a security release amount is established, and then the person deposits 10% of that money. And that's the deposit. But when the person fails to show up, a judgment is entered for the entire amount of the security, should be entered for the entire amount of the security release, which is not just the 10%, but the remaining 90% that could be collected by district attorneys and put into this revenue stream. They don't always do it, but it's there. The fact that this bill doesn't address the issue of how those judgments relate when you pay the money from the other is a legal issue that would have to be litigated unless it's addressed in the statute that you're drafting. We would like to have that addressed. I mean, if the money is going from the security deposit to the party who's owed the child support, then does the court still have the right, or the state still have the right, to collect on the money owed? Or have you somehow affected those judgments? And we think that's an issue that you probably want to address. The next technical issue that's in this bill is we noticed that judicial discretion, and you know that we always argue for judicial discretion, it's something that judges are in favor of. In this instance, there's judicial discretion for a judge to apply the proceeds of the execution of child support, but there's only judicial discretion to apply the proceeds first. There's no discretion for the judge to do anything like say, well, we're giving some of this money here and some of this money here. The discretion is very limited, only if the judge wants to apply it first. And we thought that might be an issue that you might want to chew on. Might you want to give the judge discretion to say, well, some of this money is going here, some of this money is going here, and it doesn't always have to be first. I'm going to work out the most equitable thing. The last issue, it says it on both page one and page two that the judge can only apply it first. So the discretion is limited in that strange sense, and we're not exactly sure how that will play out in the courts. And the next issue is, I've talked to you when I talked to you about House Bill 2378 of all of the entities that are in this revenue stream. And there are abused children, and there are victims of domestic abuse, and there are crime victims, and there are wounded police officers. This bill creates discretion for the judge to decide which way revenue is going. You know, is it going to child support? And that's a very noble cause and very appropriate. And the state puts a lot of work into making sure child support is collected. We've also got crime victims over here. We've got abused children. The judge has discretion to decide which way this money is going in this instance, but there's no direction from the legislature in this as to which preference you would put on it. And so the judge is put in the position of going, okay, does this money go for child support? Does it go for abused children? Does it go for crime victims? They've got a direct, and some direction of your intent in exercising that discretion would be helpful. Otherwise, you put judges in sort of politically untenable position of having to choose between crime victims and between unsupported children or between abused children and these sorts of things. So if you're going to give the judges discretion in this area, you might want to give them some direction too. Otherwise, you'll have things sort of being randomly done out there.
We like to preserve those choices for the legislature, Brad.
Well, I'm glad. Anyway, those are the technical issues I raised. Like I say, we haven't taken a position on the bill, but I thought I would raise the technical issues so you could have a chance to think them through.
Okay. Thank you. We will now close the hearing on this bill. Appreciate it. The last bill we have is House Bill 3460, and I bet I know Mr. Nieder. Okay, Jesse, then we'll open the hearing on House Bill 3460 and bring you forward. I figured you must have been related to Mr. Nieder in some way, because you're the only other person sitting out there in the audience. So, Jesse, what's your last name?
Cornett.
Okay.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse Cornett, and I reside at 2226 Northwest Hoyt Street in Portland. I'm a reserve deputy with Multnomah County. I'm not here representing anyone today except for myself. I'm sorry that Mr. Nieder had to leave. I do believe he left his written testimony with you. Hopefully you can take a look at that. Thank you for hearing the bill, and I'd like to thank Representative Krieger for sponsoring it for me. This is a good bill that recognizes reserve police officers in statute. I just wanted to give you a little background on who reserve police officers were. To be eligible for my position, I was evaluated on the following criteria, actually some of the criteria, including my driving record, my criminal history, my credit record, my moral and ethical character, how well established in my community and employment I was, my leadership ability, my bearing and appearance, and down to my physical and mental fitness. As a reserve officer, I completed 302 hours of basic law enforcement training while both working and attending college. The course I completed was offered by Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and certified at the topical level by the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Some of the members of my class came from as far south as Aurora. Some came from Hillsboro, Rainier, Scappoose. Many different agencies joined us at the Sheriff's Office for that. To maintain my position, I am expected to volunteer no less than 250 hours a year. Some officers volunteer 1,000 or more hours every year. Some of the time it's from patrolling, working special details, such as the DUI victims panel. While on patrol, we cover full-time officers as needed, perform transports, traffic stops, issue citations, work traffic control at accidents, parades, and work as perimeter security as needed. One must remain on probation after 18 months, after both the selection process and the academy, to even obtain the rank of reserve deputy. House Bill 3460 would exempt myself and all other reserves in Oregon from ORS 166250, unlawful possession of a firearm. Currently, we're implied under police officers and sheriff. This is sufficient, but it does leave some gray area that concerns some of us. If we were ever to be involved in any incidents on or off duty, sort of a question of our status may arise that is concerning. This bill would not prevent, to the best of my knowledge, a police chief or a sheriff from having a policy that prohibits reserve officers from carrying off duty if they do choose to do that. So I don't think that it removes any of their authority. It's a good bill that both recognizes reserves in statute and provides clarity under the law. It does not provide a reserve officer any additional authority or afford any additional privileges than we receive now. It simply clarifies who we are under the law. Again, I thank you for hearing this bill, and I'd be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions?
I have
for Ms.
one,
Cornett.
Chair Williams.
Yes, go ahead.
Jess, you mentioned to me earlier that you were going to be talking to your sheriff regarding how he felt one way about the bill or the other. Did you have any conversation with him?
Chair Williams, Representative Krieger, I was not able to actually speak with my sheriff. I have had conversations with the Oregon Sheriff's, Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and they actually called me this morning during the original judiciary hearing and said that they have decided to oppose this bill because, as the reason I was given this morning, it's not necessary as we already have these rights. So that's their official stance on it. And as for what Sheriff Noley, what his position on it is, it's still in the gray, and I was never able to get an answer on that particular question. Have yet to get any responses from any of the other police associations except for the Oregon State Police Association, who are neutral on this bill.
Okay. Good. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3460. And committee, thanks very much for your work today. We'll adjourn the committee, and we got another long day tomorrow. So.
Tomorrow's Wednesday.
Yeah, the civil.
Oh.
A long day. You don't have to worry about it. Not your problem.
No, excuse me.
You sound tired.
I am. I've had long committee days.
Yeah, like we're never adjourning. We're going to just keep
that's
continuing.
Fine. We'll recess, but never adjourn.